So every night we've been chanting, as you know, not every night, but almost, the Metta Sutta. And the middle part of this teaching, this discourse, describes the gradual development of heart that happens when we just repeatedly and simply incline the heart and mind over and over and over again to this friendliness, to this well-wishing, to this benevolence that is loving-kindness. So this repeated inclination of the heart again and again cultivates a heart that's inclusive, caring, friendly, tender, and yet protective, without ill will, whether we're standing, walking, sitting, lying down. But even here on the retreat, when we've been exclusively cultivating loving kindness, it's important to consider and to understand, of course, that we're not doing this in a vacuum. We develop loving kindness. We undertake metta bhavana in the bigger context of our lives and of our practice. And in these last weeks, we've talked a lot about how metta is developed, how it's cultivated, about its nature, how it works. But it's a mysterious process, isn't it? A couple of people came today during their interviews and it was exactly the same language. Basically, they started out by saying, "It was the weirdest thing." And what they were describing was, as they were cultivating loving kindness, the mind really fell quite spontaneously into a place of insight, into a place of seeing things in a very different way. So today I want to talk a little bit about this aspect of the metta practice, about how metta practice and the development of loving kindness directs the mind to wisdom. So the last two verses of the Metta Sutta that we have been chanting, you know by now very well what it says. Sitting, standing, walking, lying down. One should sustain this recollection. And then I'm going to read a different translation, a slightly different, more literal translation. One would resolve upon this mindfulness. This is known as the sublime abiding here. Without falling into mistaken views, endowed with insight and integrity, guiding away greed for sensual things, one would not be born again into a womb. So in these closing lines, the Buddha points in a concise and indirect way, in quite a condensed way, to the connection between metta and insight, between metta bhavana and vipassana bhavana. And it describes the metta practice as leading the mind and heart to this point where there is no clinging whatsoever, which is one, essentially one description of the awake mind, the mind free from clinging. So today I want to take these lines and unpack them a little bit so that we can appreciate the value of metta bhavana as it directly supports our journey from ignorance to freedom. And really remembering the context. Because as I think I'd said in the first two-week retreat, this sutta was offered as a teaching to a large group of monks who had been practicing vipassana and had encountered some rather dramatic difficulties. And they went running to the Buddha and said, "We can't practice, we can't go there, we can't stay at this place, help, help." And this sutta is what he offered them as a practice and a protection. As a practice and a protection specifically for those who were practicing vipassana. The monks who he was addressing were not, really they weren't doing metta practice. They had been practicing to attain liberation of mind. They had been doing vipassana. So to dwell with a mind freed from any kind of clinging or attachment whatsoever requires more than just concentration that's developed in the metta practice. It also, of course, needs wisdom, panya, which we develop in the vipassana practice. And just kind of as an aside, a number of you have mentioned this feeling of being conflicted, because many of us who have a long and very dedicated vipassana practice come to the metta practice and find the mind resisting the metta practice a little bit, wanting again and again to just go to vipassana. And while we make this dichotomy between samatha bhavana and vipassana bhavana, the cultivation of concentration, the cultivation of insight, really the two practices are so intertwined that dichotomy is a little bit artificial. And yes, we have this experience of the mind going to a habit of vipassana bhavana that we've established. It can also go the other way around, of course. If we have a well-established metta habit and we're doing vipassana, this can happen. It doesn't really matter, actually. We can trust ourselves and use both of these practices in support of the other. And it helps to know that there are several ways that the metta bhavana directly supports the vipassana bhavana, and indirectly. So right here, right now, while we're cultivating metta, there are attributes of mind being developed that we need in the vipassana practice that are essential for a successful vipassana practice. So we cultivate these, and often it feels like the vipassana practice is developing at the same time, in the background. And sometimes it also seems like this metta practice is like the back door into insight. Because with the development of this tender, friendly well-wishing, the mind can access aspects of insight much more easily than it otherwise could. And it does. These are those spontaneous experiences you've been reporting. So first, of course, as Saito talked about yesterday, there's concentration. And this is an essential support of the Vipassana practice. And because Saito talked about it yesterday, there's not a lot I want to say about concentration, except to say and to emphasize that the ability to access concentration has obvious benefits for the Vipassana practice. There's a quality of mind that in Pali we call viveka, which means seclusion. And we can seclude ourselves physically, which we do on retreat by maintaining silence, by restraining the senses. And viveka can also be seclusion of mind. And this is one thing that concentration gives us, is this seclusion of mind. And it often feels like we're under a bell jar. Somebody was describing this experience to me this morning, of just being completely present, but secluded from the hindrances, secluded from any tendency for the mind to wander off. And it's this seclusion that's so valuable in the Vipassana practice. And with the Vipassana practice, some level of concentration is absolutely necessary. How much concentration is necessary, of course, is a matter of dispute. Some teachers say you have to have the jhanas, and their bar for the jhanas is extremely high. Some teachers say, ugh, forget concentration, you don't need it. But very pragmatically, what is necessary in the Vipassana practice as a kind of baseline for concentration is that kind of momentary concentration that we get that's built into the Vipassana practice. And this can actually be quite strong, where we attend with that one-pointedness that Saito was talking about yesterday, moment to moment to moment, to each changing object that arises in the field of awareness. And that one-pointedness that at a momentary way in the Vipassana that attends without distraction to a single object is exactly the same one-pointedness that comes back again and again and again to the metta phrase, to the metta object. Of course, the difference being when it's momentary, it's different objects. And in this metta practice, we're attending to a single thing. We keep bringing the mind back to the same place. So the basic concentration that's necessary for a successful, quote-unquote, Vipassana practice is this momentary concentration. And it's said of those who are kind of old yogis to develop the Vipassana further, one needs to develop deeper concentration. So the metta bhavana, of course, is a very useful way to do this, especially if you develop the metta jhanas. There's a beautiful verse in the Dhammapada that Bhante Gunaratna likes very much, and I kind of hear his rendition of it in my mind sometimes. There is no concentration without wisdom, no wisdom without concentration. With both wisdom and concentration, the mind draws close to peace and emancipation. So this very much describes the intertwined nature of the Vipassana practice and the need to have some depth of concentration. And what's so wonderful about the metta practice, as I think Ariya said a little while ago, some time ago actually, was that it doesn't just develop concentration. It's not like a concentration practice where we attend to the sensation here, or you know, one single point, or to a disc of a colored disc, or to light. We're attending and cultivating loving kindness, or attending to and cultivating loving kindness. And the loving kindness, of course, in and of itself has benefits in addition to simply the concentration. And that's what I want to kind of emphasize today. Because particularly for Westerners, it's this development of kindness, of acceptance, of care, of interest that metta brings, that's such an incredible gift to the Vipassana practice. So there are a number of ways in which this development of metta benefits the Vipassana practice. Firstly, it's a form of protection. Often when we do a Vipassana retreat, metta is used at the outset as a protection and as a support. Upandita likes to liken this, using metta bhavana in this way is like having armor. He was such a warrior. He, you know, you need your armor before you go into battle. But he also talked about it as having a boat to cross the river rather than having to swim. It's a lot faster that way. So, of course, as you know, metta opens and softens the heart. It creates space when things get difficult or dry. And for this reason, Chenmya Saidao Ujjanaka, recommends beginning a metta retreat with some day, or a Vipassana retreat, sorry, with some days of metta bhavana. When I first sat with Chenmya Saidao, I had been sitting with Upandita, who, these are different strands of the Mahasi lineage, and Upandita never mixes metta with vipassana until a yogi is quite a ways along in the practice. So I come to sit with Ujjanaka, and he says, 3 days of metta. And I'm like, huh? I don't want to do that. I want to do my vipassana. I'd already been sitting for some time when I got this instruction. But of course, I did it, and sure enough, there were immediate benefits. I had been practicing already for about a month. I was in intensive retreat when Ujjanaka showed up. And the month before he came, and then what happened in the practice after those 3 days of metta were completely different because of this softening. Because of this protection. It really felt like and feels like it paves the way and makes the Vipassana go that much more smoothly. And both he and Saidao Uindaka often say, when the practice, the Vipassana practice, hits a place of difficulty, if it becomes wearisome or difficult, or we just have one of these kind of kilesa attacks that feels like a volcano's gone off, it's very helpful at those times to take a bit of a metta vacation. It calms the mind, it settles the mind, it inclines the mind away from obsessing about whatever those kilesas are telling us. It inclines the mind away from those stories. So there comes in this calmness, this peacefulness, this spaciousness. And every one of you has experienced this in the metta practice and know how powerful it can be. So by developing the skill in metta practice, as we've been doing here, and cultivating it, we get a means to incline the mind away from strong, unwholesome mind states that might arise in the Vipassana practice, so that then there is a means to see them clearly from a more stable place. And the more skill we have in developing this metta, the more of a refuge one has, and the easier it is to access. So that's protection. And then, of course, there's this thing called mindfulness, sati. As it says in the Metta Sutta, one should develop this mindfulness. But this is a concentration practice, isn't it? You know now at this point, we've said before, in a number of different ways, that yes, we are developing loving kindness. Yes, it's a concentration practice. And yes, it develops mindfulness. So developing this metta mindfulness, even though we're actually doing a samatha practice, the metta bhavana develops a form of sati, of mindfulness, which is, of course, one of the primary tools we use in the Vipassana practice for accessing wisdom. There's this inherent relationship between loving kindness, metta, and mindfulness, sati. They're not, of course, the same thing, but they do support each other in many, many different ways. And I tend to see them as the opposite sides of the same coin. In the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, mindfulness and adosa, which is the articulation of metta in the Abhidhamma, adosa meaning a lack of ill will, in other words, metta, they're both described as beautiful mental factors. And they're beautiful, what's called beautiful universals. They're beautiful mental factors that are universally present in each wholesome state of mind. So if we have a mind state that is completely wholesome, both metta and mindfulness will be present. So in each moment of completely purified consciousness, both of those mind states will have arisen. And the total development of each of these mind states of sati and metta invariably brings along the other. So Munindraji used to say, oh, metta is like the mother. Where you see metta, where you see the mother, all the children are also. And metta brings along all these other beautiful mind states, including sati. So as we've all said directly or indirectly a number of times, the intentional development of loving kindness, of metta, as we're doing it here, actually requires mindfulness. One would resolve upon this mindfulness. And by itself, the cultivation of metta both requires and develops it. We ask that you connect again and again and again with the meaning of the phrases, with the object, the being for whom you're cultivating metta, with the metta feeling. And each of these activities is a form of mindfulness, this connection. Sati, mindfulness, signifies presence of mind and attentiveness, and functions to keep the object firmly in mind. So by remembering what we're doing again and again, coming back to the phrase, coming back to the image or felt sense of this being, of course, this is mindfulness. So as you've been sitting here repeating the phrase, connecting with the meaning, you've been developing this habit of mindfulness, and you've been developing, of course, the habit of metta. We keep coming back again and again and again. That aspect of simple remembering. And that, too, is one of the most basic meanings of the word mindfulness, of the word sati, is to remember. So by doing the metta practice and by developing this metta mindfulness, it's a huge support for the vipassana practice. I kind of think of it as kind of cross-training. You run a better marathon if you know how to swim, or you do triathlons. It's the same thing. Exercise of the heart. Because in the vipassana practice, of course, we also have to come back again and again and again and again. Not to the same place, but we have to remember to be present, to know clearly each object that's arising moment to moment to moment. And even though that's a very different activity than coming back to a phrase and coming back to the metta object, it's very different than the simple well-wishing over and over. There's a common need to have a mind that remembers what it's doing, rather than drifting off here and there and getting lost and, you know, kind of forgetting. So metta bhavana strengthens our mindfulness muscles. In addition to the mindfulness, though, it also strengthens a couple of key mind states that must be present for wisdom to arise, as well as the wisdom itself. Some time ago, I think a couple of times, I know Aria and I have spoken of Saito-u Indica's kind of articulation of the spirit of metta. And one of the descriptions of the spirit of metta that he gives is, the spirit of metta only sees and looks at the good side. It never sees and looks for faults. This, of course, is the articulation of what's called in the Abhidhamma the proximate cause for the rising of loving kindness. It said that loving kindness arises as a result of seeing the goodness, and it inclines there over and over again. And this aspect of metta that sees and inclines to the goodness creates an inner attitude which is absolutely necessary for the proper development of insight. Saito Upandita puts it this way, kind of in the context of vipassana practice. He says, "Here I would like to stress the importance of adjusting your mentality to look at the brighter side of things. This is called yoniso manasikara, wise attention." And when I first read this, I was really struck by that, because the very beginning of the sentence, looking at the brighter side of things, I immediately thought, oh, metta. And then Sayadawji says, yoniso manasikara, wise attention. And this bringing together of these two really heightens this aspect of the metta that inclines the mind to an attitude that is conducive to insight. And wise attention is basically a frontline protection against the arising of any unwholesome mind states. And as well as a factor that's directly linked to right effort. When we have wise attention, we don't overfocus on the kilesa or the hindrances, and don't get so entangled with the stories. We don't feed the stories. We don't feed the stories about, oh, what a big problem these kilesa are, or how they're taking us away from the practice, or how we always get stuck there and we'll never get free, or how this fill in the blank is really our true nature. You know, so this dosa, oh, it's really me, or this doubt, oh, I'll never get free from this doubt. Or whatever stories we tell about these hindrances and these kilesa, wise attention, when it's present, prevents us from getting stuck in those obsessive thought loops that can take over the heart, that can take over our entire existence, that can feel like a bubble that we live in. And when we have wise attention, there's more of a balanced sense of proportion that acknowledges the kilesa. It doesn't push them away, but it also doesn't lose sight of everything else that's happening. The sky is blue, the birds are singing. It's a nice day outside. There are many other things that are happening besides the dosa. So it allows for that proper balance so that we are aware of that, but we're not stuck in it. It's not our entire universe. And this aspect of metta that is acceptance, that's friendliness, that's well-wishing, is what meets those kilesa, that allows them to be there, but it doesn't feed them. And when the metta practice is well-established and strong, of course, that aspect of wise attention is also developed and strong. And there are really two aspects of it, boiling down to process and attitude. So the process part is, you know, as we go through the many ups and downs of the practice, again and again and again and again, you know, one moment everything's going well and the next moment we've crashed, or one day everything goes, you know, very smoothly and the next day we can't focus on anything. And then back and forth and back and forth. As we experience this a couple of hundred or thousand times, we get better and better at navigating these times when the practice goes up and when it goes down. Because really at first in the practice, when we experience these inevitable swings, it can feel like a crisis, can't it? It's like, oh, what happened to my practice? Oh my God, what, you know, get all anxious. We think, oh, it's gone. Oh, what did I do wrong? But eventually we can meet these little swings up and down as, oh, I'm just having a dosa attack. Oh, well. Without concern. Without getting worried that somehow the practice is permanently derailed. Without thinking we've done anything wrong. With more compassion and more humor. And this kind of humor, it's articulated in the early texts in many lovely ways. If you read the Tarigata, I don't know so much about the Tarigata, but the verses of the first Buddhist nuns, these awakened women, often they take the form of a little conversation with Mara. Mara being the obstructor, the one who comes and wants to get in the way of progress on the path. And the nun is just sitting there minding her own business, and Mara shows up and whispers in her ear, who do you think you are? Or, you know, wouldn't you rather just have a normal life? Or, you're wasting your time, don't you know that? Or any number of things. And Mara is the kind of the encapsulation of what happens inside all the time, that voice that says, what am I doing here? And so in these little conversations, Mara comes and whispers his words in somebody's ear, and she goes, I see you, Mara. Or she's sitting there and thinks, this can only be Mara. And then there ensues this conversation. And some of them are quite funny. At the end of one or two of them, the nun says, Mara, you are finished. You are done. And Mara goes off dejected. And so it's as you go through these inevitable swings of the practice many, many, many times, we get better and better at wagging our finger at Mara, going, Mara, I see you. Who do you think you are? And it can actually be kind of funny. It's like, oh, that story. But I don't believe it anymore. Thank you for sharing. And we go on with the practice. And so it may be a little bit of a disturbance, but not for weeks or days or even hours. It's just a bump in the road. Because really, what living through these ups and downs gives us is this mental resilience, this resilience of heart, that gives us that ability to acknowledge these kilesa, but knows very well that they're not that big a deal. You know, that we don't have to focus on them. We don't have to tell ourselves stories about how this is going to take 20 years of psychotherapy to undo. Or, I'm always like this, I'll never succeed in the practice. Or, every moment of the day, every second without ceasing, I've been experiencing these kilesa. We see, oh, this isn't the way it really is. It gives us that resilience of heart to kind of laugh at it all. Because we know that when we can accept the fact that they're here and not make a big deal out of them, all shall be well. You know, that just frees them up to arise and pass away and as their nature sees fit. And this is exactly what that wonderful story that Urija told about the anger-eating demon is about. If we resist, if we have dosa about anything, it just strengthens it. But if we're welcoming, if we say, oh, would you like a cup of tea? Instead of going, what are you doing sitting on that throne? It eventually goes. And secondly, you know, really above and beyond process, about attitude. When metta is strong, when the mind is infused with this attitude of care, of kindness, of friendliness, of benevolence, internally and externally, that holds everything with that kind of tenderness, this directly contributes to wise attention that I was talking about before. You can't have wise attention without this friendliness. But with it, of course, small things no longer bother us. The human foibles of ourselves or other yogis, we don't spin out. And because the metta inoculates the heart and the mind, it's like it's a vaccination against getting completely lost in dosa. Even if a whole kind of suite of potentially troublesome mind states arise out of habit, let's face it, this happens. We have these habits. We have that resistance of heart that prevents us from feeding and following them, as I've said. So metta bhavana provides protection, the development of mindfulness, provides wise attention that arises out of this friendliness and care. There's also the aspect of wisdom itself. It says in the Metta Sutta that metta guides away from greed. So we gain this capacity, this habit of inclining the heart again and again and again, away from unwholesome mind states, from greed, from dosa. And of course, it also pacifies aversion. And it's that inclination over and over and over and over again, away from greed, away from aversion, that as we develop this in the metta practice, and the more versatile the practice becomes, you know, the more categories we're capable of developing metta towards, the less greed and aversion will arrive on our doorstep, regardless of what being we bring to mind and what we encounter. And of course, when this happens, the more pliable, malleable, and easeful the mind and heart are, no matter what we experience, no matter what we're faced with. This is what the texts refer to when we talk about breaking down the barriers. I talked a couple of days ago about the ego and how it breaks down those barriers that the ego builds, or how the metta breaks down those barriers that the ego builds. And those barriers are built from craving, from fear. It says in the Dhammapada, verse 212, from craving springs grief, from craving springs fear. In one who is free of craving, there is neither grief nor fear. So when we don't have grief and fear, there is no craving. And this is the boundlessness of metta that rests in the middle of all beings impartially. A couple of you have mentioned today in your interviews. Interviews today were really interesting. A lot of people coming in with a lot of interesting things. And a couple of people talked about how, the metta across the categories, there's no difference. This is that impartiality, that boundlessness, where there isn't grief, fear, craving. And without grief, without fear, without craving, wisdom blossoms. Because when we can access this non-judgmental attitude through the cultivation of metta, it invariably kind of bleeds into our vipassana practice. Exactly because metta attenuates craving, fear, greed. It creates that conducive inner environment for vipassana insights to arise. And it contributes to that unshakable equanimity that's essential for the deepest levels of insight to arise. As Saito was saying yesterday, metta does not develop equanimity because there is that well-wishing on a worldly level. But it's this impartiality that we develop when we do the metta practice that contributes to equanimity. Because we're not holding towards or against different beings. And further, in addition to this equanimity, metta erodes self-centeredness, that atta-mana I was talking about the other day. And the experience of impartiality that results when atta and mana are eroded or dispersed by the metta can powerfully turn the mind towards anatta, that not-self nature that is an aspect of all conditioned phenomena. And it can strengthen whatever insights we already have into anatta. And it's not at all uncommon for people to come in and report quite strong experiences of anatta, insights into anatta, while they're doing the metta practice. And these are the kind of reports that I was talking about at the beginning of the talk, when people came in and said, it was so weird. I was just doing the metta practice, and then all of a sudden, there was no self and other. There was no ego. There was the boundaries went away. And this is precisely the articulation of that place that the metta practice brings the heart to. So the more metta practice we do, the more these insights can strengthen and become consolidated. And what's so great is that one of the most wonderful things about the metta practice is that it does its work, as we've said a number of times, with the grit and nitty-gritty of our everyday conventional lives. We work with these human categories and these other beings. It enters the door of the Dhamma through the conventional world, through our relational lives. It's all about relationship. So there's a very natural integration that happens of these insights into anatta and our everyday lives. And that understanding of anatta that we get through the metta practice can be very vivid here and now. And in the midst of these concepts that we have of our everyday life, these conventional concepts that we have to use to be in this human realm. So while the practice of metta bhavana does not directly, or we don't undertake this practice with the intention of developing these insights into anatta, it's not explicitly directed towards the development of wisdom. Wisdom definitely arises and can come to fruition as the metta and vipassana practices mature together. So really each of these practices supports and reinforces the other. As we cultivate this even-hearted benevolence with the metta practice, tranquility and a really palpable sense of connectedness arises. And as we see experience from all sides and from all angles in the vipassana practice, metta becomes the natural inclination of the mind. And there's this lovely positive feedback loop that begins to happen, propelling both the metta practice and the insight practice towards more insight, more happiness, and more peace. Bhikkhu Nyanamoli puts it this way: the practice of loving kindness alone will give effect in some measure the insight into the nature of existence with all its mirages and deceptions. It's when the practice of loving kindness is perfected by right view that it is lifted out of the impermanence of even the highest heavens and directed to the cessation of suffering. So when we do this metta practice, it gives us a certain amount of relief from suffering. And when we do the vipassana practice and we see through to that pure right view, that together with the metta practice is what lifts the heart and directs it to the true cessation of suffering. So these many blessings of the metta practice to us as insight meditators, as Vipassana yogis, how it settles and protects the heart, how it develops concentration, mindfulness, wise attention, equanimity, and how it leads the mind step by step towards wisdom, towards clear seeing. We just have to patiently do it. And in this respect, I want to share one of my favorite verses from the suttas, from the Majjhima Nikaya. Many of you, I'm sure, will know it. Let one not revive the past, or on the future build his hopes. For the past has been left behind, and the future has not yet been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today, the effort must be made. Tomorrow, death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus, ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage, has said, who has one fortunate attachment. And I read this verse because at this point in the retreat, it is very natural for the mind to begin to go to the past, to go to the future, to reflect about what's happened, to think about where we want to go with it or where we are going next, to plan future retreats or other travel, to kind of begin to wrap it up. First, I want to thank all of you for your ongoing dedication to the practice and to encourage you to keep going. Tomorrow, death may come. Who knows? There are still a number of days left in this retreat. If you were sitting a one-week retreat, you'd only just be going. You know, the practice would only just be rolling now. And at this point in everybody's practice, you have momentum of loving kindness. The metta and the concentration are going, are gaining. Never mind if you don't think so. I urge you not to assess your practice or where it is. Everybody has momentum. And it's like a marathon, you know, you don't crest the last hill and see the finish line down there and go, okay, never mind. You never get there that way. So just to keep going. So while I said the other day, relax, 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 now it may be the time to, in a relaxed way, keep putting one step in front of the other. Make a little effort to simply maintain the momentum of the practice, to, when those thoughts come of the past, of the future, to say, thank you for sharing. This is Mara, by the way. Oh, yes, oh, you know, next retreat. Thank you for sharing, Mara. I'm still in this retreat. And it's just a matter of keeping the practice going. Munindraji used to say, just put your body there. Just sit, just walk. Pay attention in your general activities to the cultivation of loving kindness. Often, you know, when we begin to go off habitually at the end of a retreat like this, all it takes is to just remember to kick the practice habit back in, and then it goes by itself. The fruits of your previous work will do the rest. So if you have one thing to be attached to right now, please remember this quote. And it doesn't mean this kind of warrior-like relentlessness. It's just keep going. Side by side, these two precious teachings the Buddha offered us, these metta teachings, these vipassana teachings, offer a way forward and really an urgent instruction. We don't know when we'll die. We'd like to think it's when we're, 90 decades in the future. The thing is, we're all right here, right now. So, we urge you to continue your dedication to the practice. And thank you for your dedication to the practice. There's a way it's articulated here in Burma. Often the Sayadaws ask us to practice respectfully. And that's practice respecting ourselves and practice respecting the Dhamma. And what that simply means is to keep going. We have right now to cultivate loving kindness to the capacity that we can cultivate it. It's a rare opportunity, and you've all worked really hard to get here. So while you're here, please keep going. And by doing that, you'll have this wonderful, powerful ally at your side, this metta, as a wonderful support for your life and for your practice. I want to close today with a verse from the Jatakas. Just as water cools both good and bad and washes away all impurity and dust, in the same way, you should develop thoughts of metta to friend and foe alike. And having reached perfection of metta, you will attain enlightenment. So, you have some days. May by this beautiful practice of loving kindness, may we all reach the perfection of metta and attain enlightenment.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.